Okay, welcome everybody to the Temple Courts. It's great to have you this rainy morning, although it's not raining here because it never rains in California, as you know. Okay, so I'm going to start the slideshow. Okay, great. So I'm going to be doing the presentation for 2 weeks, and we're just talking about why we should be able to believe in Jesus, why we should be able to believe in the Bible. If you want to get a book that I've done on this topic, it is Reasons for Belief, available at IPI. All right, so today I'm going to talk about a couple of different things that relate to why we can trust the Bible. First of all, I'm going to talk about the reliability of the actual biblical text, the history of the biblical text, and why we can... why we can assume that it is indeed what God originally had written. Then I'll talk a little bit about history and archaeology, how that relates to the Bible. I'll at least mention the idea of dealing with supposed contradictions of the Bible. And the next week we'll just look at evidence for Jesus, which honestly is even more exciting topic to me, although this is a pretty exciting topic. Okay, great. So you hear stuff, if you spend much time on the internet, especially if you deal with Muslim apologists, and they'll tell us that you can't trust the New Testament because the early church changed it. Constantine took the whole parts about Jesus not being God out of the Bible. The Muslims would say the Bible is corrupt, and therefore, you know, when it disagrees with what the Quran says, obviously the Quran is true. The Bible's been changed. And then you hear more specific charges, for example, that John 5, 3 through 4 was not originally in the Bible. And you hear things like there's hundreds of thousands of errors and copying errors in the Bible. And at least 50% of the Bible is of the New Testament is not even in the original. I hear these things all the time. I don't know if you do. So I want to talk about that, and I would say that these charges that you hear are a mixture of grain of salt truth, utter fabrications, completely irrational, and obviously completely untrue things. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you my conclusion before I start. My conclusion is this. I believe that the New Testament, the Greek New Testament we have available to us, is well over 99% representation of the original. And I'm going to show the evidence that makes that conclusion, I would say, almost inescapable. So first of all, I'm going to talk about the New Testament evidence. There are something like 5,700 ancient Greek texts, including, as we'll see, dozens from the second century. And we'll go into that. And in fact, the New Testament text is by far better attested than any ancient document, by far, as in there's no close second. Actually, the second best attested ancient document is the Old Testament. All right, so let's talk about some of the document evidence that supports the New Testament. You see a couple of cool manuscripts that. To me, going to like the Chester Beatty Museum there in Dublin is like a kid in a candy shop. So here's a famous manuscript. It's actually in the Rylands Museum in Manchester. When I was in Manchester, I went to Manchester United Stadium. That was cool. But then I went to the Rylands Museum, which is way more cool. This is a fragment of the Gospel of John, and it's been dated to roughly 125 A.D., which means around 40 years after the original. And it's got John 18:31 through 33 on the front and John 18:37 on the back. And here's from the Sackler Library, which I believe is in Cambridge University. We have a fragment of the Book of John from roughly 150 A.D. We have the Magdalene manuscript, fragments of Matthew from 175 A.D. If you go to the Chester Beatty Museum, there's a room full of 2nd and 3rd century manuscripts. This one is a good-sized chunk of 2 Corinthians from 200 A.D. And then Then what we have is entire Greek New Testaments from the 4th century. In fact, the Codex Sinaiticus, Codex Vaticanus, and Alexandrinus are actually on vellum, and they're the entire Greek Old Testament and the Greek New Testament. And this is from about 300 years after the original. Codex Sinaiticus, there's a great story there. It was discovered on Mount Sinai. There were some manuscripts that were about to be burned, and a scholar saved those. So we have entire Greek New Testaments from about 350 A.D. Interestingly, because people say, well, you know, obviously everybody knows that Constantine took things about reincarnation out of the Bible, and Constantine, you know, was the church decided that Jesus was God, and so they changed it. But they're claiming this happened at a time we have actual copies of the entire New Testament. Also, if you want to put together a reliable Greek text, we have thousands of manuscripts. By the way, there's a copy of the Codex Sinaiticus. I was in the British Museum. I took this picture right before they said, hey, you can't take pictures. Too late. So there you go. If you want to get a feeling for the kind of manuscript evidence we have, look at this list of information. All right, so you can see, for example, nobody questions the writing of Aristotle, Aristotle's physics and the different things he wrote, and yet the time between when Aristotle's originals were written and the oldest manuscript we have is roughly 1,450 years, and we only have 5 manuscripts of Aristotle. Does anybody say, oh, you can't trust Aristotle's writings? How do you know he wrote it? I never hear that. Or what about Herodotus? Herodotus, the most important historian in the Greek world, along with Thucydides. Herodotus, we only have 8 copies of only a small fraction of what he wrote. And the oldest manuscript we have is 1,350 years younger than that which was written by Herodotus. We could talk about Plato or Julius Caesar. And then you go down the list, and you can see the number of Hebrew manuscripts that we have of the Old Testament is 5,000. The New Testament number of ancient manuscripts is 8,000. By the way, just so you know, that 8,000 includes ancient Latin, ancient Syriac, and Coptic. The number of Greek manuscripts is closer to about 6,000. So when I say the amount of evidence we have to support the reliability of the text for the New Testament is vastly greater than any other ancient document, I am not exaggerating. Also, notice the time gap. Whereas all these others, and these are the famous documents from the ancient world, all the others, 1,000 years, 1,500 years, the time gap between when the New Testament documents were written and the oldest manuscript we have is probably just under 50 years. All right? And then what we have is we have quotes from the early church fathers. It's been said that you can reconstruct almost the entire New Testament simply from quotes from church fathers from the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century. In fact, I've said that enough times, I thought I better do some research. So people have actually counted, and something like 60% of the New Testament can be reproduced from such quotes. And this includes many quotes from the 2nd century and even the very end of the 1st century. So if the New Testament had been changed, which obviously it hasn't, then what you'd have to do is not only would you have to burn all the existing manuscripts, which you didn't succeed in doing because we have some from the 2nd century, you'd also have to burn all the quotes. And there are thousands and thousands of these. For example, Ignatius, in roughly 115 A.D., quotes from Matthew, John, and Luke. And that's just the Gospels he quotes from. He quoted from several other letters of Paul. Polycarp, in 120 A.D., he quotes from Matthew, Mark, Luke, Acts, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, 1st Thessalonians, 1st and 2nd Timothy, Hebrews, 1st Peter, and 1st and 3rd John. Now, this is important not only for establishing the reliability of the New Testament text, but also in establishing the canon of the New Testament. You know, you hear people saying, oh, the New Testament books were selected in the 4th century. That's a bunch of nonsense, folks. That is a bunch of nonsense. And if somebody tells you that, they're not telling you the truth. I'm going to talk a little bit about the canonization in a few minutes. Then we have Clement of Rome writing in probably 95 to 97 AD. And Clement quotes from 10 of the New Testament books. And if you read the letter of Clement to Rome, he quotes the Old Testament and he quotes the New Testament almost exactly the same way. And when Clement is writing, he's almost like a running just quote after quote after quote of the Bible. That's kind of how he does it. And by the way, you might have heard, what about the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary? What about all these other documents? Not a single one of these writers ever quoted from any of these except to point out that they weren't true. For example, Irenaeus published a thing against Celsus where he quotes the non-canonical writings to show how bogus they are. So now I want to talk about the canon of the New Testament. By the way, I could say a lot more, but I want to move through several topics this morning so we can get to the question and answer. So what about the canonization? Like I said, you hear it all the time. You hear it from Muslims. You hear it from atheists. And you even hear it occasionally from people who claim to believe in the Bible, that the canon of the New Testament was established at the Council of Nicaea or Ephesus. That is simply not true. All right, what you can see on the screen is a guy named Ladovio Muratori who discovered this fragment. And what it was is a list of the New Testament books from about 175 AD, which has all 27 of the New Testament books on that list. All right, so let's talk about how the New Testament itself came into the form that we have. I can say with great confidence that by the 90s AD, all four Gospels, sorry about that, by somewhere in the 90s AD, all four Gospels were being passed as a group around the churches. And we know that because we can tell even from the way they would quote. For example, sometimes when you're putting together a sermon, you're going to quote first Matthew, then Mark, then Luke, and then John, and that sort of thing. So we can tell not only that all four Gospels were circulating through all the churches, but they were actually being circulated sort of as a unit. Also, we know that by the 90s, similarly, there was a collection of Paul's letters, probably not all of his letters, possibly 1 and 2 Timothy, Titus, and Philemon were not included yet. But by the 90s AD, a corpus of Paul's writings were also being passed through the churches. In 140 AD, a heretic, Marcion, published his own canon. Before 140 AD, there's no evidence that the Christians were like publishing an official canon, but Marcion publishing his canon, which I could explain that if you have a question about that, it motivated Christians to start publishing a canon. So here's my conclusion on the canonization of the Old Testament. And I believe I'm being conservative and careful here. I'm not exaggerating. By roughly 150 AD, a still somewhat fluid but nearly set list of canonical books was being read in the church. There was still some doubts about the inclusion of Hebrews, 2 Peter, Revelation, 2 and 3 John. And yet, actually, all of these books were being read in all of the churches. There were a couple of other books that some people were saying can be read with some level of authority, such as 1 Clement and Didache. But basically, the New Testament canon was virtually set, but not in concrete, by 150 AD. And Irenaeus, by the way, in 170s, lists all 27 books. And he lists them as being essentially what we'd call the New Testament. He says there was still some discussion about a couple of books, but essentially by 200 AD, the New Testament canon was fixed, unchanging, and never changed after that. Okay, here we go. Irenaeus, who called the Gospels the four pillars of the church. There you go. There's my conclusion. 200 AD, the New Testament, as we know it, was canonized by acclamation of the church. Okay, what about the Old Testament? By the way, scholars who are not overly, you know, biased, you'll hear numbers like something where between 99% of the New Testament is fully agreed, that the manuscript evidence says there's no question about 99% of the New Testament. Some people say 99.8%, something like that, because there are a very, very, very small number of questions about a few verses in the original, Luke 23. There's a couple verses there. There's some famous things about John 8 and 1 John 5, but those are settled questions. I'll answer those questions if you have it in the question and answer. Okay, next I want to talk about the Old Testament. Now, I'm not going to say 99.5%. I'm not going to say we have the exact Hebrew Old Testament to the 99.5% level, but I would say we have the Old Testament with dramatic and incredible precision as it relates to the original. So let me talk a little bit about the Old Testament. Now, we have a number of sources of evidence to support the Hebrew Old Testament. First of all, we have the Masoretic texts. A few examples of that are on the screen here. The Masoretic text, I'll explain that. And, of course, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls. But also we have the Septuagint, the Samaritan Pentateuch, and a number of translations of the Old Testament into other languages that were done before Christ. So we take, and plus we can do quotes from the Mishnah and the Targums and all these other Jewish writings, some of which come from before Christ. So actually, the number of kinds of evidence that supports the Old Testament is even greater than that which supports the New Testament. So let me talk about the Masoretic text. I don't know if it was good or bad, but somewhere in the 8th, 9th century, Jewish scholars decided to take all the available Hebrew texts they had around the Jewish world and create an ideal best text, kind of like what we do. Scholars today will publish what is the most accurate Greek text. But then what they did essentially was they got rid of all the old ones, or almost all of them, and so they formed what's now known as the Masoretic text, which was a very carefully assembled scholarly Hebrew text. And so until fairly recently, you probably know where I'm going with the Dead Sea Scrolls, until fairly recently, our oldest Hebrew manuscripts were, for example, the Cairo Codex, Hebrew text from 895 AD, which had most of the Old Testament, the former and latter prophets. Then the Aleppo Codex from Aleppo, which unfortunately that city has been destroyed, but that's a whole other story. The oldest entire Hebrew manuscript from 920 AD, the Leningrad Codex, and others. All right? And the Masoretes and the Talmudists were crazy, ridiculously careful about how they made copies. For example, the Talmudists, who were copying Old Testaments after the Masada situation, this is in the from the 2nd to the 5th centuries. And these are some of the rules they had. A synagogue roll must be written on the skins of clean animals, prepared for the particular use of the synagogue by a Jew. They must be fastened together with strings taken from clean animals. Every skin must contain a certain number of columns equal throughout the entire codex. The length of each column must not extend over less than 48 or more than 60 lines. The breadth must consist of 30 letters. The whole copy must be first lined, and if three words be written in it without a line, it is worthless. The ink should be black, neither red, green, or any other color, and should be prepared according to a certain recipe. An authentic copy must be the exemplar from which the transcriber ought not to in the least deviate. No word or letter, not even a yod, which would be a vowel mark, must be written from memory, the scribe not having looked at the codex before him. Between every consonant, The space of a hair or thread must intervene between every word, the breadth of a narrow consonant, between every new section, the breadth of 9 consonants, between every book, 3 lines. The fifth book of Moses must terminate exactly with a line, but the rest need not do so, blah, 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 blah. And these guys, they treated the Old Testament with a level of reverence that it's kind of crazy. Think about your most crazy perfectionist you ever knew, multiply it by 10. And that's how the Jews treated the Old Testament text. Nevertheless, if you look from the writing of the Old Testament, which ended around 400 BC, close to that, to, let's say, the Cairo Codex, we would have a roughly 1,500 years, kind of similar to Thucydides or Plato. Of course, as a lot of you know, we have other evidence, for example, the Dead Sea Scrolls, all right, which close that gap by a lot. And there's the famous story, in fact, I think National Geographic did a thing on the Dead Sea Scrolls just a couple months ago. The cave there, the children, 1947 shepherd children, threw a rock down into a cave and they heard it hitting some pottery and they went down and they found scrolls, the famous Dead Sea Scrolls. Here is an image of the Isaiah scroll, which was an entire copy of Isaiah. This is Isaiah A, I believe, which is from roughly 150 BC, a nearly entire Isaiah scroll from around Isaiah B from around 200 BC. And this picture gives you a sense for what this really does. Because before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the time frame between the oldest manuscript and the time it was written was around 1300 to 1400 years. And the Dead Sea Scrolls covered 80% of that gap. 80%. All right, at least, for example, between Malachi or Nehemiah and the Dead Sea Scrolls. And what's interesting is, for example, when they published the Revised Standard Version in 1952 to reflect the potential changes between the Dead Sea Scroll Isaiah and the Masoretic Text Isaiah, there were only 13 very minor changes that were proposed between the Masoretic Text and the Dead Sea Scrolls. All right, and then what we have also very significant is the Septuagint translation, because the Septuagint translation was made around 230 BC, which is, you know, on the front end of some of the oldest of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And by the way, I didn't mention, we have at least fragments of every single Old Testament book amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls except Esther, an entire Psalms and other books. Okay, got it? But I also want to mention the Septuagint. The Septuagint is a Greek translation of the entire Old Testament that was made somewhere around 230, maybe as late as 200 BC. There's some debate there. The exact history of the Septuagint translation is not fully known. So what we have then is a snapshot. So even if later there were copying errors in the Septuagint, either way, the Septuagint is a snapshot of the Hebrew Old Testament in translated form from somewhere around 230 BC. And interestingly, if you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, some of those Dead Sea Scrolls are a bit closer to the Masoretic texts, and others are a bit closer to the Septuagint. We also have the Samaritan Pentateuch, which was a translation of the first 5 books into essentially the Samaritan language from somewhere between 400 and 500 BC. These are the kinds of evidence we have. So, as F.F. Bruce, the scholar, said, the new evidence confirms what we already had good reason to believe, that the Jewish scribes of the early Christian centuries copied and recopied the text of the Hebrew Bible with the utmost fidelity. All right, so again, I could say a lot more about the canonization of the Old Testament and the process there, but I promised two topics, okay? So I want to get to my second topic, and I'm probably going to have to cover this one. Oh, I got 20 minutes to go. That's good. So I want to talk a little bit about why I believe that the Bible is reliable. It's also evidence that the Bible's inspired. The manuscript evidence does not show in any way whatsoever the Bible's inspired. What it shows is the text that we have available to us for translation is virtually the original. When I talk about history and archaeology, now I'm talking about both the reliability of the Bible and the inspiration of the Bible. Because if you compare the Old Testament and even the New Testament to any other ancient histories, the Old Testament is more believable history than any other. For example, Herodotus was one of his nicknames was the father of lies, not because his history was necessarily unreliable, but because he was so biased. If you read the ancient histories by the Assyrians or the Babylonians or the Egyptians, they never lost a battle. Their leaders were perfect. The Old Testament is not like that. And I'm going to, like I did with talking about the reliability of the text, I'm going to begin my discussion by telling you my conclusion. My conclusion is this. The Old Testament and the New Testament are by far the most reliable historical documents we have from the ancient world. And again, there is no close rival. Now, I would say maybe Herodotus and Thucydides are a little closer to the Old Testament than, for example, comparing the manuscript evidence. But nevertheless, the Bible is by far the most reliable source of history from ancient times. By the way, there you see a picture from the black obelisk of Shalmaneser of King Jehu bowing before Shalmaneser. One thing interesting to note is that you won't find this kind of evidence in Israel. You will not find bas-relief sculptures of Jewish kings. You know why? Because God told the Jews to not make a graven image. So that I'm glad God said that. It maybe reduced the amount of idolatry amongst the Jews, although not very much, honestly. But unfortunately, it meant that we don't have that kind of evidence. But anyway, before I start, just look at a few things. Let's ask ourselves, starting from the time of, say, Abraham through, say, Nehemiah and the return from captivity, when would we start to see actual physical archaeological evidence of things left behind by the Jewish people? It certainly wouldn't be in the time of Abraham, who lived in a tent, or Moses. They didn't build large structures. Actually, the earliest time you could expect to find actual physical archaeological sites that would reflect biblical history, it would probably be during the time of the United Kingdom. And in fact, that is when we start to have, you know, actual stones that I can show you. Before that, we have to have more like indirect evidence. We need to have evidence that shows the biblical world, as, for example, described in Genesis, reflects the actual world of Mesopotamia in that time. And by the way, that's exactly what you find. Some people say that Moses wrote the book of Genesis. No, he didn't. Because the book of Genesis reflects the world of Mesopotamia around 2000 to 1800 BC, and Moses knew nothing of that. Moses might have had some role in putting in its final form. Anyway, let me get to the evidence. I go on. Okay. So, for example, we have the story of Abraham, who was born in a large city, a large and wealthy city, according to the Old Testament, of Ur. And Ur has been excavated. And Ur was probably the largest and wealthiest city in Mesopotamia around 2200 BC. There is the large ziggurat in Ur. You can see some electrical poles there. Those were not in the original. All right, and then according to the Old Testament, then Abraham and Terah went to the city of Haran. And you get the sense that Haran was maybe a bit more of an outpost, kind of on the edge of Mesopotamia. Sure enough, Haran is in eastern Syria. Haran has been excavated, But Haran was abandoned roughly 1600 BC and was unoccupied after that. So let's imagine you believe what these liberals or these skeptics say, which is Genesis wasn't even written until 500 BC, and it was just a bunch of stories people made up in order to tell their children to be good for them or something like that. Well, if that's true, how did they know about the city of Haran, which literally hadn't even existed for over 1,000 years? I'm telling you, this idea that Genesis was something written in the first millennium BC is just crazy. Can't possibly be true. Then we have the Ebla tablets. The Ebla tablets from a city, the Ebla tablets are from roughly 2100 BC, and there are thousands of these tablets in clay. Most of them are things like ledgers of sales and tax revenue and stuff like that. But some of the names that are found in the Ebla tablets include Isaac, Jacob, Abraham, Terah, Nahor, and Sarug. By the way, those are not the biblical persons. They're just random people that lived in northern Mesopotamia around 2100 BC. But what that means is those names, Abraham, Sarah, Jacob, those were common names in the physical location where Abraham and his family lived at the time he lived. Let's imagine somebody somebody gave you a letter and said, yeah, this is somebody sent me this yesterday, mentioned names like Gertrude or Harold. You go, no, definitely not. That's really old. Or what? Let's imagine you got a letter and somebody said, this letter is from 1870, and it's talking about Jamal and Brittany. You go, no, but definitely not. There's other interesting things. For example, the story of Laban chasing Jacob down several days through the desert, not to get his daughters back, but to get the household gods back. What's up with that? And then a document was found, I don't know if it was Sumerian or Babylonian document, in which it said, those who possess the household gods gain the inheritance. So here's an example where the biblical information doesn't make sense outside of the context of something that was the cultural context of Mesopotamia in roughly 1800 to 2000 BC. And then there's the five-city alliance. There was the battle where Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboiim, and Zoar were fighting in a battle against Chedorlaomer from Elam. And again, you know, the skeptics say, you know, Sodom, whatever, no such thing. You know, the whole idea of God raining down fire from heaven, nobody can believe that stuff. And if you go to the Dead Sea, and this is, by the way, the southern end of the Dead Sea. If you go to the Dead Sea, it is the most desolate desert maybe in the world, probably not quite, but close. And yet the Bible describes farming, right? The Bible says that Abraham stayed up in the hill country, but Lot went down to the green and the lush agricultural land around the Dead Sea. And of course, the opponents of Christianity laughed at this. It was like, who could believe this? But then, I believe it was the 1980s, some archaeologist said, well, I don't know, let's go look. And what they discovered is if you look, you'll find that there are deposits in these wadis, when these are periodic streams, which only flow during rain events. But the evidence was around 2000 BC, these were flowing year-round. They weren't torrents of water, but it was sufficient water, and there was intense irrigation and intense farming. And guess how many cities they discovered? Five cities, all of which were destroyed by fire somewhere between 2200 and 2000 BC. The largest of them is called Bab ed-Dra, it's the northernmost. Probably it's the city of Sodom. It had layers of ashes as much as 7 feet thick. There was a graveyard about a half a kilometer outside of the city. It had wooden structures in it, which had been burned from the top to the bottom. Normally, when you burn, by the way, cities being burned down, that is not unique. That in itself doesn't prove anything about the fire and brimstone. But these wooden structures were burned from the top to the bottom. Generally, when you burn down a structure, it burns from the bottom to the top. So what we have here is significant evidence of the destruction of these five cities, and none of them were ever inhabited again. What about the Hittites? Here are some of the ruins from Sodom. What about the Hittites? If you go back and read critics of the Bible, especially from the 19th century, when you could make these crazy claims, they would say that the Hittites and the Hivites and the Jebusites and the Amorites, these are just, you know, made-up stories. There were no such people. Actually, the Hittites are mentioned 47 times in the Old Testament. And if you read the Old Testament, you get the sense the Hittites were kind of a major power, more than the Canaanites, Hivites, Jebusites. In fact, there were three rival powers, the Hittites, the Egyptians, and the Assyrians. And it turns out the evidence is that's true. In fact, the capital city of Hattusha of the Hittites was discovered in 1906 by Hugo Winkler. And it turned out it was a large city, and the Hittite Empire covered most of what we call Turkey today, as well as parts of Syria and Iraq. In fact, here are the gates of this city that people used to say was a mere fantasy, a made-up story by Jewish writers making up stories just to try to get people to believe in this make-believe God that we call Jehovah. Well, I happen to believe the Hittites are real people. I believe the Hivites, Jebusites, Canaanites, and all those otherites. I believe all of them are absolutely real people. Why? Because the evidence demands that I believe that. In fact, there are even universities where you could actually study the Hittite language and get a major in Hittite studies. All right, here we're talking about some of the earliest times. Let's talk about the conquest. By the way, we have no direct evidence of the Jews having been in Egypt, just so you know. If you hear skeptics saying that, don't try to argue with them because it's true. But here's why. Think about the situation for the Jews when they were living in Egypt up until about 1400 BC. They were slaves. They had hovels. What would they have left behind? What would you even hope to discover? Similar with the wandering in the wilderness. We will not, I can't say absolutely. I would say 99.99%. We never will discover any physical evidence of the wandering in the wilderness. But it just so happens there are a group of letters called the Tel Elamarna letters, which are from the city of Elamarna, which was constructed around 1400 BC. There are dozens of these. And here is a quote from one of the Tel Elamarna letters. The Habiru plunder all the lands of the king. If archers are here this year, then the lands of the king, the Lord, will remain. But if archers are not here, then the lands of the king, my Lord, are lost. So this is a minor ruler from Palestine writing to the Egyptian pharaoh saying, come help, because the Habiru, or the Hapiru, are trying to conquer us, coming apparently from outside. Well, I don't know, Hapiru, Hebrew, I don't think that's a very big stretch. Does this one document prove the conquest by the Hebrews of the Promised Land occurred in 1400 BC? I would say that'd probably be a little bit of a stretch, but I would say we have pretty good evidence that this is something that actually happened. I could talk about the evidence from Jericho, other things. But like I said, we're not going to start to see actual physical things in the promised land until the time of the United Kingdom and then the Divided Kingdom. But then we find such evidence. For example, there's the Moabite stone, also called the Stone of Mesha. Mesha is a Moabite king mentioned in the Old Testament in 1 Kings 16. And this stone, which is in the Louvre, you know, when people go to the Louvre, they want to see, Da Vinci's Mona Lisa. I want to see the Moabite stone. It's awesome. Anyway, so, and it mentions Abraham of the house of Omri. So what we have then is confirmation, not only that there was an earlier house in the Northern Kingdom, the house of Jeroboam, but there was another dynasty that succeeded the dynasty of Jeroboam, which was begun by Omri. So I'm beginning to think that maybe Ahab was an actual person, and that Abraham was, Ahab was a king descended from, I believe it was his grandfather, Omri. Okay, and then we have the black obelisk of Shalmaneser. I actually took the picture on the upper right, but it's hard to see. And what you have here, it's from the Assyrian king Shalmaneser. The year is 840 BC. It's in the British Museum. And it reflects what we could read from 2 Kings 17, 3 through 6, which says that Jehu gave tribute to Shalmaneser. It doesn't mention Jehu actually going to Assyria, to Nineveh, or Nimrud, whichever city it was, to give the tribute. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. It's possible that this base release inscription is sort of symbolic. Whether he went there or not, I don't know. But here we have probably the oldest actual carving, if you will, of a Jewish person, whose name we're well familiar with, Jehu. All right. Then there's the Tell Dan inscription. There are two cities named Dan. This is the northern one, the one that's near Caesarea Philippi. And I've actually been to the city of Dan. You can go there and see the altar where Jeroboam set up the altar to worship these calf idols. Anyway, there in the 1980s or 90s, a friend of mine, John Wilson, was actually in Dan the day that this was found. It was found in a rock and a wall. So basically what they would do is they would rebuild cities that had been destroyed. They would take the old rocks and make the new wall. And it just happened randomly. An archaeologist looked, the sun angle was just right, and she saw this inscription. And here's what it says. It says, I killed Jehoram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, and I killed Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, king of the house of David. So what we have here is confirmation from around 820 BC that there indeed was a royal line that goes back to probably over 1000 BC, which was begun by King David and the son of 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 King David is Jehoram. Now, what he says here, this is Hatzael, the king of Aram, he claims that he killed Ahab and Ahaziah, but it's actually not true. If you read in 2 Kings 8, 20 and 29, that actually Jehoram was wounded. He left the scene of the battle, and Jehu later killed him. Now, I've got a question for you. This is an easy question. We have two versions of the events. We have Hatzael's version, which says that he killed Jehoram. And then we have the biblical version, which says, no, he was actually injured. He was killed later by Jehu. Simple question. Which is the more believable account? And I'm telling you, we all know which is the more believable account. It's the biblical account. So I believe that David was a real person. I believe that Solomon was a real person, as was Saul. Okay, I just have a couple more because I'm running out of time, and I want us to have plenty of time for question and answer. Here's the Sennacherib cylinder. It looks like this huge thing. It's in the British Museum, but it's only about this tall. The writing is tiny. Anyway, here, Sennacherib is boasting about his campaign in Judea, in which he destroyed almost every town in Judea and took them captive, which, by the way, reflects what you can read about in Isaiah 36, 18 through 21, 1 Kings 18:1 to 19:37. But here's what he says. As to Hezekiah the Jew, he did not submit to my yoke. I laid siege to 46 of his strong cities, walled forts, and to the countless small villages in their vicinity. I drove out of them over 200,000 people, young and old, male and female, horses, mules, donkeys, camels, big and small, beyond counting, and most importantly, and as to Hezekiah himself, I made a prisoner in Jerusalem, his royal residence, like a bird in a cage. So what Sennacherib says is, I laid siege to Jerusalem, but what's missing is whether he ever conquered Jerusalem. I'll tell you this right now. If he had conquered Jerusalem, it would have been on the Sennacherib cylinder. So why is it that the most powerful king in the entire Near East at that time was unable to capture Jerusalem? Well, then you can go to Isaiah or 2 Kings, and you can get a pretty good feeling for why. Because what happened was the angel of the Lord destroyed his entire army in one night. So what we have here in the Sennacherib cylinder is indirect evidence of a miracle recorded in the Bible, which is the destruction of Sennacherib's army. Okay, the Lachish letters, that's really cool. This is from 588 BC, where a person confirms in precise detail the destruction of Lachish and later on of Jerusalem. This is not when Sennacherib came, this is when Nebuchadnezzar came. Or we have the Cyrus cylinder, which is really cool, confirming some of the things in the book of Ezra. I don't have time for that. My last story, it has to do with, we're back to the Ziggurat. If you read in Daniel 5, what we have is Belshazzar offering Daniel the third highest place in the kingdom. If you read Herodotus, if you read other ancient writings, they say the last king of Babylon was Nabonidus. And yet the Bible says it was Belshazzar. What's up with that? And so, of course, as usual, the critics of the Bible say it's because Daniel's not true. It's just a story made up. You can't trust Daniel. Come on, give me a break. Not true. Fabrication. Fable. But then in the Ziggurat Nur, they found an inscription that explained what happens. You see, it turns out Nabonidus had a palace coup, which brought him to power, but he was not directly descended from Nebuchadnezzar. So what he did was he married the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, and he had a son who was Belshazzar, the biblical Belshazzar. So Belshazzar was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar and legitimate heir. So what Nabonidus did was he made Belshazzar his regent king. And he ruled as regent king in Babylon for 17 years. That explains why when Belshazzar offered the third highest place in the kingdom, not the second highest place, it explains why. Because he occupied the second highest place in the kingdom. So in this case, the biblical information is far more reliable than other ancient histories that were written at that time proved by this discovery. I could talk about the reliability of the New Testament and Luke as an historian, but I used up my time. I wish I had time to talk about supposed contradictions in the Bible. I could answer questions about that if you like. There's a lot of stuff there. All right, but I don't have time for that. So here's the first slide of next week's talk. Who is the real Jesus? I guess I gave this talk in Ubon, Thailand, but now I'm going to be giving it over Zoom in Massachusetts. So I'm going to stop sharing and we can take some questions.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Oakes. That was really awesome. Very, very encouraging, I think, to see the evidence for the scriptures that we have our hope in. Very powerful stuff. So we're going to have a Q&A for probably about 20 minutes here. And so if you guys would like to either send a message in the chat and I can read that out, or if you also just want to ask yourself, you can raise your hand and I'll sort of bounce back and forth between calling on people and reading out questions.
Christina's from Connecticut also. Good for her.
There you go.
So anything related to our topic or maybe off topic would be okay. Dore?
Yeah, hi. I was wondering, because you mentioned that Moses didn't write the Old Testament, but it came from Mesopotamia, and I was wondering, when people ask us who wrote the Old Testament, that what answer shall we give them?
By the way, that is not what I said.
Okay.
What I said is that Moses probably didn't write the book of Genesis.
Okay,
I didn't say he didn't write, say, Leviticus or Numbers or Deuteronomy. By the way, he didn't write the entire book of Deuteronomy. Clearly there was an editor after the time of Moses, because it mentions his death and a couple of things that happened after he died. So we have no idea who wrote the book of Genesis. Almost certainly, the book of Genesis was compiled from oral traditions. But my point is this, those oral traditions go back to Mesopotamia around 2000 BC. When exactly it was written down, we simply don't know. And so we don't want to make claims about evidence we don't have directly. There were probably literally dozens of different writers of the Old Testament. There's the sons of Korah. There's Asaph. And there's David and Solomon and who wrote 1 Kings? Who wrote 1 Chronicles? We don't know. We know who wrote Isaiah, although there's some people that say there were two different authors in Isaiah. It's possible there were. The point is this, Dore, which is the entire Old Testament is inspired by God. I'm going to talk about the evidence for that next week. It's reliable historically, and it is a quite accurate reflection of the original writings. We do not know who wrote 1 Chronicles. We don't have their name. In fact, a general rule in most ancient documents is people didn't sign their name. Even Matthew didn't say, "Hi, I'm Matthew, I wrote this book." And so so we have to infer from the information we have and make reasonable guesses. But I would say over half of the Old Testament, we simply don't know who wrote it. All right. Anyway, it's a tradition that Moses wrote the entire Pentateuch. But the fact is, there's very little evidence other than tradition that Moses wrote Genesis. And there's fairly significant reason to believe that he didn't write it. He may have had some role in maybe putting it together in the form we have. And there's some evidence. For example, there's places in Genesis which says, back then they did such and such things. So we know that the final form of Genesis was put together probably even as late as 1000 BC. There were editors. Okay? Good.
Yeah, the next question I see, we can go to the chat this time, is from Gary, and he said, what are the Gnostic Gospels? And where did they come from, and what's wrong with them?
Okay, good. So there's many documents. There's a thing called the Nag Hammadi Library, which is found in a desert community called Nag Hammadi, below a monastery. And there they found, I don't know, a couple dozen documents. So there's the Gospel of Thomas is the most famous one, Gospel of Judas. And there are dozens of these things. And so it's hard to describe them all in one way, but the evidence is that these were written by heretical groups. Some of them were Gnostics, And, you know, like I said, the most famous of them is the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Judas. In the Gospel of Judas, Jesus is a spiritual being who occupied this body which was not his. In the Gospel of Judas, the God of the Old Testament is an evil God, a physical God. And this is Gnosticism. In the Gospel of Thomas, it has Jesus turning clay figurines into birds, and you know, Jesus speaking from the cradle. You know, goofy, crazy stuff. In the Gospel of Thomas, it basically says that something about because Mary was a woman, she couldn't go to heaven, or something bizarre, crazy like that. There's no evidence that any of these documents come from the first century. In fact, all the evidence says they certainly didn't. Some of them come from as late as the third century. It is true, for example, that Irenaeus quotes occasionally from the Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Judas, and he quotes them to show how bogus they were. And none of the early church fathers, not one ever quotes from any of these Gnostic documents, not once, except perhaps to say that these are out there, but these are written by heretics. And one thing you can do is, if you want to understand how you can read the Bible and simply from reading it tell that it's inspired, go ahead and read the Gospel of Peter or the Gospel of Mary. By the way, these things aren't Gospels. The Gospel of Thomas doesn't have the birth of Jesus. It doesn't have any parables of Jesus. It doesn't have any miracles of Jesus, except when he was a baby. And it doesn't even recount the death of Jesus, because that's kind of embarrassing to Gnostics. All right. And so, sure, there's a number of these. But again, also, if you want to understand, kind of get a feeling for what an inspired book is, what you can do is you can read the Old Testament Apocrypha, Tobit, Judith, Second Maccabees, Wisdom of Sirach, etc. Read these and kind of go, you scratch your head. Okay. So there, some of the early church actually believed these were inspired. Really, wow, man, they're more skeptical. They're more gullible than I thought. And so, again, reading some of these other books that some people have tried to claim are equivalent to the New Testament or the Old Testament, and it'll help you. It'll increase your faith. You know, there was the book The Da Vinci Code. I know you got to be old to remember the Da Vinci Code. You got to be at least 40 to remember the Da Vinci Code. But anyway, and in this book, the movie, the characters say there were like 50 different Gospels. First of all, no, there weren't. And they say, well, there was this competition in the early church, and finally those bad, mean, horrible Orthodox Christians drove all the other ones out and just created this. The four Gospels. That is not true. We have Justin Martyr saying there are exactly four Gospels. There only have ever been four Gospels, and there is literally no evidence. In fact, even the Gnostics, such as Marcion, even they don't quote from the Gospel of Thomas. I'm not kidding you. All right. Next question.
Awesome.
I think Michael was raising his hand. Michael?
Yeah.
Maligny? Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, John.
Hi.
Yeah. Hi, John. Thank you so much for helping us build our toolbox of arguments for in favor of the historicity of the Bible. I have a quick question about, maybe it's not quick, but a question about the Bible compared to other documents in religions like the Quran and, you know, with nowadays a lot of misinformation flying around on on social networks and kind of new realities of text and things. I'm curious what, you know, with you know, Christianity, there are like almost 3 billion people in the world that claim some kind of Christianity, and another 1.8 for Muslims, and then, you know, you have Hindus and so on. I'm curious, how does the Bible compare with other religious texts that, you know, large numbers of people are relying on? And how as Christians do we talk about that with people? I meet a lot of Muslims and Hindus now through the university. I'm curious, are there some points that we can make about, and are there areas we can study to kind of help us? Not, I don't want to criticize the text, but I want to be able to talk about them in terms of their historicity. And, you know, I don't know
if
there's any way we can make that case. But.
Right. Yeah. Josh, the intern here in Bakersfield, took a class on scriptures of you know, ancient religions, and that's a fascinating subject. It's really fascinating. And the answer is, go to my website where I've got tons and tons of stuff on this. If you go, I think you could do a search on the word reliability. You'll find about a 10-hour class that I did, in which I discuss Hindu scripture, Buddhist scripture, scripture of Islam, etc. And the answer, it depends on which religion you're talking about. For example, until you have a conversation with the Hindus wouldn't defend their scripture as inspired in anything like the way that we would try to defend the Bible as inspired. In fact, the only reason they would is because they're interacting with a Christian as sort of probably out of a kind of a defensiveness. And so, for example, I once had a Hindu guy who was very, very upset with me. He was interacting through my website because I said that Krishna is not even a real person. He's a myth. And he said, how could you say that? He said, Krishna is a real person. I said, well, all right, let's talk about Jesus. I know when he was born. I know where he was born. I know when he died, where he died, how he died. I know the name of his mother, his father, three of his brothers, several of his friends, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what's be the equivalent for Krishna? He went away. It took him about 3 weeks. He came back. Well, Krishna lives somewhere between about 1,800 B.C. and 200 B.C. in a town which we're not sure exactly where it is. We're not sure if it even really existed. I'm telling you, Krishna is a mythical figure. He's not a real person. And if the Vedas or the Brahmanas or the, you know, the different scriptures of Hinduism are inspired, they would, the evidence for them to be inspired would be somehow that you find yourself agreeing with them. Not because of things like fulfilled prophecy or historical reliability or even anything remotely like that. The same can be said for Buddhism, Taoism. It's the only other religion that even remotely has anything even remotely similar to the Christian scriptures would be that of Islam, at least as far as an ancient religion. All right, and anyway, I don't know. The internet's been blowing up with Muslim haters. Most of them, not all of them, haters. A lot of some of them aren't. Most of them are. And they're trying to undermine the reliability of the Bible. But what you can't get them to do, and I'm telling you, cannot get them to do it, and they will not do it, is to discuss the reliability of the Quran. They just make statements. You know, are there any historical things recorded only in the Quran for which we have historical archaeological evidence? The answer is not a single thing, not one. Are there any bona fide prophecies made by Muhammad or in the Hadith or in the Quran, which later on were fulfilled in precise ways, like, for example, Isaiah 53, Psalm 22? The answer is there is none. We did a debate with Shabir Ali a few years ago. We put on that debate. Doug did it for our side. And Shabir Ali, who's probably the most prominent defender of the Quran from an apologetic perspective in the world today, he was put in a tough spot because he had to defend the Quran to be inspired. And his evidence for inspiration was using the number 19. Interesting ways the number 19 pops up in the Quran. Basically numerology. That's what he's left with. So I agree with you, Michael, I agree with you that we should treat the scriptures of other religions with respect. We should not treat others the way that Christianity is treated all the time. We should show respect and not throw stuff in their face, even if it's true about Muhammad. We should be reticent to do that and less forced to. But I would say there is no other ancient document which shows clear evidence of inspiration. There is none. That's my conclusion. And there's a reason for it, of course. But again, with different religions, the kind of evidence is broadly different. So,
yeah. I think it's important as a Christian to read those texts and understand the historicity, so that we can talk about them in a compassionate,
scholarly. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
It's just great that we have a text that has so much historical relevance and background.
Yeah.
It just reinforces our faith, of course. So thank you.
Sure. All right. Do you have time for one or two more?
Yeah, I wanted to read one from the chat.
Great.
So this one's from Jenny. It says, what is your opinion on the woman caught in adultery? I think you mentioned it, the John 8 passage, I think.
Yeah.
That often, whether that's authentic or
yeah.
not, I think.
Yeah. There are a number of interpolations, not a small number, and they're fairly significant, but there's only about five or six that are worth mentioning, significant interpolations. That would be 1 John 5, I don't know the exact verses, these three testify. Then there's John 5 about the angel stirring the waters. There's Mark 16, 9 through 21, which is possibly not in the original Mark. And then there's John 8 about the woman caught in adultery. And I'm missing one. That's it. Now, for 1 John 5, John 5, these things are clearly interpolations that clearly were not in the original text. For the thing with the angel stirring the water, there is no manuscript, I believe, older than around 900 AD that even has that in there. And these are clearly interpolations done by people. Perhaps they simply included something from the margin when they copied it, or maybe a well-meaning but foolish person trying to help in some way. John 8 is the woman caught in adultery is kind of like those, but not like those for a significant reason. Number one, John 8, the woman caught in adultery, is in almost all of the manuscripts. In fact, there's only about three or four significant manuscripts that it's not in. But those include Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, and Alexandrinus. So almost all the manuscripts have the woman caught in adultery, but the thing is, the very, very small number that do not happen to be the most authoritative ancient manuscripts. And by the way, I don't remember off the top of my head, but one of them has the same thing except at the end of John. Another one has like a blank spot representing that he knew it was there, but he chose not to include it. And it's quoted as early as the late second century. So here's my conclusion. My conclusion is, almost without doubt, the story of the woman caught in adultery is an original tradition that was part of the oral tradition that everybody knew and used and been quoting for a long time. But it's fairly likely that it was not in that exact spot in the original Gospel of John. So I discount 1 John 5, verse whatever, these three testify. I believe that was definitely not said by John, and it doesn't belong there. But I believe the story of the woman caught in adultery absolutely is an actual story, possibly was in one of the original Gospels, but probably a better than 50% chance was not in that particular spot in John, in the original John. So, I definitely use the woman caught in adultery because I believe it is what happened. I believe it's an accurate reflection of an actual thing that happened.
so much, Dr. Oakes. This was really awesome. Awesome teaching and a lot of good stuff. I think Richard has a couple things to say now. You're muted, Richard.
All right. Well, Dr. John Oakes, thanks so much for your presentation. Very, very helpful. I appreciate it. Just want to acknowledge all the work and all the study, on the historical reliability of the Bible. Obviously, we don't even have enough time to gather all that is there, continue to build our confidence, in the reliability of the Scriptures. You know, one of the things I know, every so often you listen to a lot, but there are a few things that really jump out to me, as I listen to all that you have to say. I know for me personally, one of the things that you presented was actually when you were going back to the documents, and you said history is fairly biased. You look at a lot of the Assyrian text and the Babylonian text, and I think it was you mentioned the Assyrians, and actually when they write history, they've never lost a battle. But in the Bible, it is not like that. And that's really resonated with me, because when you read the Old Testament, you just see that, sometimes God's people actually win and sometimes they don't, and there's sort of an honesty and authenticity to it, of course, along with all the evidences that you have presented. So again, that's definitely one of my biggest takeaways. For some reason, that just really resonated with me, and it helps me to go back and just read it in that context. So thanks again for your presentation. You can actually check out Dr. John Oakes' website for much more material. I had a chance to, to peruse that a little bit, and there's a whole bunch of PowerPoints there, with all kinds of lectures and material there. Dr. John Oakes, would you like to just sort of give us that website address? I think it's Christian Evans's. Is that what it is?
Close. Here we go. I'm going to type it in.
Okay, great.
It's kind of long. We should have had a shorter name. There you go. Evidenceforchristianity.org. And I'm going to post this audio. I'm going to post the PowerPoint and the notes for this presentation. And I'll probably just go ahead and put up the notes and PowerPoint for next Saturday as well, so people can look at that. And there's about 4,000 articles there. There's a lot of stuff, so feel free. Everything's free.
I'm sure you guys have time to read the 4,000, so knock yourself out, okay? all right, so next week we are going to be back here again for another hour plus or so. We're going to be talking about who is Jesus. And I know that that's a particular sweet spot for you, Doctor and Dr. John Oakes, and I really appreciate that. We look forward to hearing about that. I want to encourage you, if you're visiting this morning, you can actually, if you look down in the chat, you'll see our welcome site and the Boston Church. If you want to know more about, if you would like to study the Bible, or just get to know more about even what Dr. John Oakes talked about, you can go ahead and just fill out a Connect card. And we will make sure we follow up with you, all right? And so, but also, I just want to encourage you guys to come on back next week. And for those of us who are on call, who are members of the church, you got a sample of where we're going with this. And this is our speaker's corner for the Central and eventually the Boston Church, where we invite different speakers to come on in and present. So think about who you can invite next week to hear about who Jesus is. All right, so once again, thank you so much for your presentation, Dr. Oakes, and we look forward to seeing you next week. All right? So thanks, everybody, for attending, and I hope this was very helpful to you.
Yeah, thanks for coming, everybody. See you next Saturday.
I'll just stay on here, Kendall. Dr. V, John, if you can just stay on for a little bit. We can.
Sure. Oh, there's the question about the books in the Catholic Bible, but I did address
recording
that.
Recording stopped.
Good. Da-da-da. Do I think Moses wrote Numbers? I think he wrote most of it, yeah. But probably not the whole thing. Good. Questions, thoughts?
Yeah. Well, thanks again. I thought it was a great presentation. That's a lot that you did in such a short period of time. I know there's a whole lot more there that you can do. You know, again, the crowd that was on today, obviously, we had, well, there's Nate and Grace who were also on.